and welcome back to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? Welcome, 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 or as our guest would say from Land Down Under, Jim, g'day.
G'day, how are you?
Brilliant, Ray. That accent is spot on.
I've had years of practice.
All right, our guest today is a member of parliament from part of Melbourne, Peter Khalil. When I was in Australia, Peter was one of my most trusted and valued interlocutors, explained to this poor Yank what was going on and how to think about it. Peter was elected for the first time in 2016 to parliament, but before that, he served in the coalition in Iraq as an advisor. Then he was national security advisor to Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. So he has a deep national security background. And Peter, glad to see you.
Great to see you, Jim and Ray. It's wonderful. I also lived in Washington for a couple of years. I was at Brookings, so I miss DC. Not in the summer, it's too hot.
I do not miss DC.
It's good to have someone miss DC. Well, we're going to start off the way we always ask our audience questions. And we're going to say, why should Americans care about foreign influence efforts in other countries like Australia?
Well, we all should care, and Americans should care, because fundamentally, foreign influencing behavior and foreign interference, and they're two different things, are having a detrimental effect on, I think, our national interests, both Australia and the US, in the sense that if we believe that we want to see security in the Indo-Pacific, which is a very important part of the world for the US as it is for Australia, stability in that region, and the prosperity that flows from countries adhering to a rules-based order or a liberal rules-based order in the sense of international norms and laws that countries abide by, so that we can trade with each other peacefully, people abide by the security frameworks in place, and we can actually all prosper, then we should be very concerned by the fact that foreign influencing behavior and foreign interference seek to undermine and diminish that order, if you like. Now, probably the best way to think about this is visualize an iceberg. 95 or 97% of the iceberg is underwater, and that's where unseen, what we call the gray zone attacks, if you like, where you have this unprecedented level of foreign influencing behavior, foreign interference, espionage, sabotage, meant to try and diminish our democratic system, our systems, our institutions, our governance, our democracies. That's happening under the water in the iceberg, and we don't see that. Most Australians and most Americans don't see that. The top couple of percent we might see when there's a cyber attack on one of our companies or one of our universities that make the media, but it's a very small percentage of what's going on. And I can say that the levels of this influencing and interference and sabotage espionage is unprecedented. I think the levels are way, way higher than they were during the Cold War. They are significant. They're problematic because they impact who we are as people, our democracies, our systems, our values. And that's why we should care. Now, the difference between foreign interference and foreign influencing is an interesting one. People sort of get that confused sometimes. There is legitimate influencing behavior. So, for example, if you've got the embassy of Fiji in your country trying to influence you to take a holiday to Fiji because it's a beautiful resort, that's perfectly legitimate foreign influencing behavior. But when it becomes, when it crosses the line into that sort of grayer area where it's influencing in an insidious way, it's seeking to undermine an institution or parts of our democratic system, then that becomes a problem. And interference is much more active efforts to try and intervene and interfere either through diaspora communities or within our institutions and our political class to try and get outcomes that benefit adversaries. And of course, espionage and sabotage are pretty clear cut in the sense that there's direct efforts to try and break down some of our systems, for example, cyber attacks that stop some of our companies or our institutions, universities or hospitals from working, stop them from working. And that is particularly insidious and a direct threat to our democracy in a much more serious way. So all of these combined, though, are quite significant, and they're unprecedented, particularly over the last 5 to 10 years.
So, Peter, both Jim and I were in Australia at the embassy in 2018 when Australia passed, you know, that big foreign interference legislation. And that was actually a pretty seminal moment, it seemed like, in Australia, and led to, you know, led to all kinds of outcomes that were maybe surprising in many ways. But let's start with, how did that come about? Why was there foreign interference legislation? What prompted it? And you know, who was involved?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story there, because obviously the increase in some of these gray zone attacks from adversaries, both state actors and non-state actors, and we know the usual suspects in the state actors, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, but also China and the CCP. Clearly, there was a real increase or an escalation of some of these efforts being made in foreign interference and foreign influencing behavior, espionage, and so on. As I said, unprecedented. And so there was a reaction in Australia to that, the need to put together legislative responses and national security frameworks to try and address these issues. And I think this was happening globally as well. I'll just say a general point about that. It wasn't just us. I think the Western democracies and democracies around the world started to wake up to what was a significant threat to their values systems, their democracies, their governance. The whole wolf warrior diplomacy that you saw with China, the aggressive nature of that, some of that effort that was being conducted to undermine some of the our communities and our systems, it really, I think, shocked Western democracies out of a complacency that had set in over a long period of time where, yes, clearly the economic relationship with China, for example, was so important to so many countries, and particularly for Australia, it still is very important as far as 25% of our exports go to China, and it's a very critically important economic partner. And I think the same with the US, the partnership there, the economic relationship was so significant that people were lulled into a sense of, just doing the business and seeing the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow in Beijing and dismissing, I think, some of the other elements in the relationship. And so the West was awoken to this, I think, and sort of jolted out of our complacency. And there's been a reaction to some of this that has been significant. I think maybe the CCP maybe overreached in their view that they had an inexorable rise as the next great superpower, and that was sort of unstoppable. Nothing is set in stone in history, historically speaking, but I think the West is now reacting, and there's a kind of a very dynamic engagement and response that is occurring, and there's a bit of a race on technology and things like that, whether it's AI or quantum and so on. But for our case, Ray, in respect to what our response was, you know, we were in opposition at the time. Now we're in government, the Labor government, the Albanese government. But at the time, we were in opposition in 2017, 2018. And I remember there was this big, big kerfuffle around the government. The Turnbull government at the time wanted to sign an extradition treaty with China. Now, we opposed that. And we sort of sent a left party and we said, no, hold on a second. You know, sending people back in this extradition treaty is really problematic because of, you know, our view around the death penalty, legal safeguards around fair trials and so on and so forth. And so we opposed that and we forced the government not to go down that path in signing the extradition treaty. And I think that was a real turning point in the political will around standing up and responding to those gray zone attacks and all of the interference that was occurring. And that led to a series of legislative changes as well, including the Foreign Interference Transparency Scheme. Now, as it happens, my committee, the Intelligence Security Committee, actually had a look at how well and not well, or how it's actually operated over the last couple of years. And we've kind of ripped it apart because it wasn't really fit for purpose, the Foreign Interference Foreign Influence and Transparency Scheme. We've made significant recommendations to reform that scheme, to bulk it up, to make it actually fit for purpose. But that kind of gives you a bit of the history, at least in our political process, about how we started to put together some of these laws. And credit to the previous government for putting those legislative program together for national security reasons. And we've had a much stronger set of responses, and our government as well in the last couple of years have added to those around the critical infrastructure laws, protection of critical infrastructure, the TOLA laws, the different laws around what we consider to be important elements of our economy for national security reasons, and beefing up the security around those areas. Cybersecurity and beefing up cybersecurity and cyber defense has been a critical part of what we've been doing over the last couple of years as well. So as I said, the response has been quite firm. The other elements of the response too, just to look at it strategically, is clearly we've beefed up our cybersecurity and our cyber defense at all levels. We're also moving towards increasing our and improving our defense capability, and doing so with partners. Now, AUKUS is one example of that. You can criticize it one way or the other, but the point is, in the bigger picture, beefing up that defense capability for Australia, in a sense with partners like the US, the UK, but partners in Southeast Asia as well, is about collective deterrence and creating a deterrent effect for adversaries to think twice about whether they would seek to reach their strategic objectives through the use of force, that it might be too costly to do so. And then also the diplomatic effort that has been made. So combining all of these things has been part of the Australian government's strategy in the last couple of years to make Australia a partner of choice for Pacific countries, for Indo-Pacific nations, for us to work that middle power diplomacy to build up a very strong foundation of partnership and alliance across the region. And it's not easy to do that, by the way, because a lot of these countries, you know, come traditionally from the non-aligned movement and they play a transactional game. But certainly with our strong partners, Japan, South Korea, the US, Australia, others in India now as well through the Quad, really beefing up the support for that rules-based order through cybersecurity efforts, cyber defense, defense capability, intelligence assets, beefing up our domestic protection of our national assets, our critical infrastructure. These are all things that have been happening in Australia at a very rapid pace as a response to that unprecedented level of foreign influence and foreign interference efforts and espionage and so on. So I think it's been a really rapid deployment, if you like, and change that we haven't had this kind of level of activity in decades, to be honest with you. And certainly the volatility of the geostrategic environment has been so startling to so many people. It hasn't been as volatile as this probably since the days of World War II. And we've had to respond to that quite rightly.
Well, Peter, you mentioned that the level of activity is just increasing exponentially. And your director of national security also indicated that the levels of espionage efforts are just something he's never seen. So I guess the question is, can government move fast enough to respond to all this, especially getting ready for elections where risk of deep fakes of trying to influence the ethnic Chinese Australian community without people being accused of racism, very difficult problems.
That's a really good question. I mean, I think there is an unrelenting effort, I think, by the government, and there is bipartisan support from the opposition on this, to protect Australians and our way of life and our democracy. And the law enforcement and intelligence agencies have this huge challenge, Jim, you're right. Their efforts, and we've got to provide them with the resources, which we are, to investigate, to disrupt where possible, and to prosecute acts of foreign interference is a huge challenge because, as you said, AI, the use of social media, the dissemination of misinformation and disinformation, the insidious nature of that, very hard for governments and government agencies and law enforcement and intelligence agencies to deal with this because it's so massive a challenge. There is ASIO is our Australian Secret Intelligence Organisation, and AFP, our Australian Federal Police-led Counter Foreign Interference Task Force. They're actively investigating foreign interference cases. A key feature of my role as chair of the Intelligence Committee is our work to address or to assess national security legislation that can provide the scaffolding, the architecture to strengthen the structures in place from a legislative framework sense to provide the foundation for our law enforcement and intelligence agencies to commit to these challenges and to deal with these challenges. There is an important layer, though, and you mentioned the multicultural communities and the risk that it may be seen as racist to target a particular community. There are 1 million strains of Chinese heritage. They're absolutely critical and important part of our multicultural fabric and our society. They've made enormous contributions in business and academia and so on. The vast majority of them are proud and patriotic Australians, if you want to use those terms, and they are a very important part of our multicultural society. There is obviously in the diaspora community attempts through various social media channels and so on to influence the diaspora community as well. The important thing is the resilience that we build within that multicultural society and the cohesiveness of that society. It's actually an asset of ours against attempts by external states or non-state actors to try and influence behaviour. There's a resilience within Australian society against those foreign threats. And there's a cohesion in our multicultural society that I think, I wouldn't say it's the envy of the rest of the world, but it's looked upon by other parts of the world as well. Wow, you guys have got people from all over the world and you live in a relatively harmonious, multi-ethnic, multi-cultural, multi-faith society where there's a degree of tolerance and acceptance. That didn't occur by magic, by the way. That occurred by through generations of Australians' hard work and goodwill to build this. It's actually at risk now because of some of the international conflicts we're seeing, like Gaza, and what we're seeing with misinformation and disinformation tearing apart at it. But I think it's still an asset of ours, and that's an important part of the tools that we have at our disposal to push back on that kind of foreign interference and that foreign influencing behaviour. I think we've got to bring to bear all of the elements of our national, all of our assets, our national assets, our resilience to deal with these issues. And one of them, actually, one of the challenges we have is a kind of indifference, or I wouldn't say an apathy, but a kind of, out of sight, out of mind, until it sort of affects people personally. They don't really think about it that much. So the challenge I have as well publicly when I speak in the media is how much do I alert the public to the threats that are there in the iceberg underwater without alarming the public about those cyber threats and whatever else, but at least doing enough so people understand that there are serious issues that they need to be aware around their own cyber hygiene, if you like, that's a bit of a challenge. You don't want to over egg it, but at the same time, you want to be very clear with the public that there are these issues that we are dealing with, and we're trying to get that balance right.
Peter, about 5 years ago, there was a task force set up in Australia on foreign interference focused specifically on universities. What is it about universities in Australia or elsewhere that makes them especially susceptible, or at least susceptible enough so that you have to actually focus a particular task force on that problem?
Yeah, the academia has been a particular target of foreign interference activity and foreign influencing behaviour. Structurally as well, there's been obviously a number of institutes like the Confucius Institutes that have been funded from the CCP and the United Work Front, which is a sort of front that is used by the CCP to engage, if they say engage, with local communities, but also the influencing side of things when it's gets into that grey zone area becomes a problem. And so universities and academic institutions have been a particular target in that space. And then there's also the issue around research and research grants and also research in areas of sensitivity, whether they be research in military type technology or dual use technology and IP around that. So that's been an area of concern. And so there had to be a response to that to address some of those issues. And that's why that was set up again. And there's been a number of actions taken to try and address, for example, the dual use issue, making sure sensitive technologies and other areas aren't just sort of just wandering off offshore without any proper accountability and look at that and the importance of that for Australia's own defence and security as well. So I think the other aspect of it is on, obviously these institutions are important as an important part of our society because students are going through studying. There's an influencing attempt there which around the worldview and around democracy and around. I'm concerned in the sense that some of the polling has shown younger people, you know, have less and less trust in democracy. There's such a deficit in democracy. They equate, you know, autocratic systems almost on par with democracy, and this is a concerning thing. And I know it's a very indirect line that I'm drawing here, but all of this adds up, especially when you know, younger generations are going to be moving into positions of responsibility and political power and influence in within society. The fact that that is happening is of some concern. So all of these things taken together, Ray, meant that there had to be some sort of response to really protect universities and colleges and academia, almost like critical infrastructure. You know, the same way we've put laws in place to protect water facilities or important national infrastructure that relates to our economic resilience, we've had to do the same with universities.
Well, it's good to know that you're working on the academic dual use issue, because that helps with our pillar two cooperation for sure. But you mentioned, Peter, the how much of the subterranean, underwater iceberg you share with the public. And I guess we're all about transparency, with Ray spending a lot of time shedding light on Chinese activities in the gray zone. Is more information sharing with the public better, so they're aware of what's going on, or is it just scaring the horses?
Well, that's a really fundamental question. It's a political question as much as anything else, because it depends how you use it. If you are using an issue that, you know, one of the gray zone attacks, for example, if you're using it for the purposes of whipping up fear and even at its sort of extreme level, a racist response towards Chinese Australians, then it's unacceptable. And there are political actors who would use it in that way for domestic short-term political gain. I've been critical of those in the past, using these issues to whip up a scare campaign, to whip up fear, to whip up, anger towards fellow Australians. I think that's unacceptable. But if you're using it to educate and inform the public that there is a genuine and a serious risk that is occurring with respect to, attacks on our academia or on our hospitals or on our parliaments, these are the fundamental institutions in our democracy, then I think that is entirely legitimate. And that's what I've tried to do in my public engagement, is to explain to people that we have a very important relationship with China. This government is trying to reduce the temperature and the tension that had existed in that relationship previously. And we're doing so because we believe that, as the Prime Minister has said, we can agree where we can. We will agree where we can with China. We will disagree where we must. And that is based on the principles and our values as a democracy, and on human rights and issues like that, where we have to raise those issues and stand firm on those principles. We've tried to reduce the temperature. We've tried to ensure that we get some wins on the economic front to reduce tariff barriers, for example, and so on, which is beneficial for the Australian economy and for Australians and their jobs. But at the same time, we have stood firm on our principles and also increased our cyber capability, our cyber security, our defence capability, our intelligence efforts to ensure that we deter, whether it's China or anyone else, from trying to use those types of actions or the grey zone type actions to achieve their strategic objectives, to lift the cost for them in doing so, to increase the cost in doing so, to deter them from doing so. Now, that's a very difficult strategy. I've called it the narrow path. It's a very narrow path that we're traversing, one which we're trying to get that balance right, but also trying to avoid confrontation and conflict while not while standing up still for our principles as a democracy. And the path is, like, on either side of the path, it's beset by minefields and booby traps and all the rest of it. One wrong step could go very wrong. And you've seen, for example, very unprofessional behaviour by the PLA with respect to certain actions taken which have put in danger our defence personnel. There was flares that were thrown up in front of one of our Navy helicopters on exercises off the coast of Korea. a UN or a joint exercise that we were conducting on sanctions with North Korea. There've been some very unprofessional conduct with respect to dangerous actions taken with respect to our divers, our Navy divers in another theater. Like, and we've stood up on that. We've raised that very clearly. We're not standing back on that. We're making it very clear to our to the Chinese counterparts, and the defense minister did so at the Shangri-La dialogue, that that is unacceptable. And he raised it directly with the Chinese defense minister. So we are traversing a very narrow path. Ultimately, we all want to avoid conflict. We all want to avoid confrontation. But at the same time, we need to also stand up for our democratic principles and the way of life that we have. And that shouldn't be sacrificed in order to avoid conflict either. So that's why it's such a difficult and narrow path to traverse. And it's not easy. I think it's very, very difficult. So it's a balance.
Peter, I'm going to sort of get you out of here on maybe this last question, which is, since you were talking about Defense Minister Richard Marles and his discussions with the Chinese, and you were also talking about Australia's allies and partners. One that you didn't bring up directly, but I know that has been on Australia's mind recently, has been the Philippines. And yeah. Defense Minister Marles was recently in Hawaii at a group of, you know, together with a group of four other, of his counterparts, including Secretary Austin and the defense ministers from Japan and the Philippines. And the in the Philippines, at least, this grouping has taken on a new term. Or this new term on the international stage, the Squad, to distinguish it from the Quad that includes Quad. India. And I just wonder, you know, we've also seen a group sail not very long ago with these four nations sailing in the South China Sea together. So I wonder, you know, what do you see as, you know, the future of this kind of a grouping in the Indo-Pacific between sort of these like-minded democracies? And, you know, is this a thing? Are we going to start seeing more of the Squad?
Great question, Ray. And I think now we're talking about the sort of strategic the multilateral architecture, if you like, in the region, Indo-Pacific. There's been a lot of activity in this space. And I've been pushing on this for a while. I've written about this. I conceptual framework that I have is around what I would call middle power diplomacy, but also what I call a middle power fulcrum. Fulcrum being a, you know, a leg that props up a chair, a table. The fulcrum of middle powers are necessary, working together to provide such a strong scaffolding or architecture, if you like, that holds up the liberal rules-based order, because it's in their national interest to do so. Now, there are many countries that see this in the same way, that are that feel that they're not large enough to reach their objectives through the brute use of force on their own. They need to partner up. They need to have friends. And together, that collectively, there's a deterrent effect, but there's also an effect of really reshaping that rules-based order in the region. And the other point I would make, this can't be just us protecting, you know, in amber, the liberal rules-based order that was set up, you know, post-World War II, as great as it is and as important as it has been for prosperity in our region, it needs to evolve. And how it evolves means that it, in my view, requires those Southeast Asian countries, those partners in the region, to be part of that evolution. Once they have ownership over that, they're more likely to want to protect that because it's in their national interest. It's in their benefit. Philippines, Marcos, President Marcos was here in Australia. He spoke very strongly in our parliament. I went to a couple of the meetings there with the PM and the Deputy PM, and when he spoke at various events in Melbourne as well. I think his strategic view of this is very similar. I would say that there are countries like Indonesia where they are critical nations to this effort, this middle power fulcrum. Countries even like Vietnam, which is not your gold standard democracy, who have their own particular reasons why they would want to push back on a superpower neighbor that might try and just arbitrarily get their way. They're also involved, and we've been building up the relationships there. But each country is different and the challenges are different. So there will be things like the Squad. And what I've argued for is that there should be a multi-level, multi-layered attempt of trilaterals and quadrilaterals and other various forms of groupings that work on different initiatives, if you like. So you could have a trilateral with Australia, India, and Vietnam that looks at piracy or whatever it might be, working together in a military sense, security, intelligence, building up those relationships, building up that scaffolding, so that even if you look at it visually like a webbing of all these countries interlaced together in all of these different ways, it's strong. It's strong. It's difficult to break. And so if a superpower, whether it be China or even the US under a different administration, try to breach some of the rules of the road on trade or security, they won't be able to do it so easily through brute force or because of their strength in that respect. That's what I think is absolutely the vision for the development of the Indo-Pacific multilateral architecture going forward, that middle power fulcrum, that webbing, if you like, of all these countries together. Now, that's easier said than done because a lot of these countries are transactional in nature. They'll try and play off, China and the US, and they'll play off each other. We've had the challenge, obviously, in the Pacific where, I don't know if you would know, but there was, in our first year of government, the foreign minister did a terrific job and the prime minister of going out to nearly every Pacific country, because there was a very concerted effort by China to sign a 10-nation Pacific security deal. We convinced a lot of those countries not to enter into that deal, and they chose Australia as a partner of choice. That was a lot of diplomatic effort, to convince them that the better path was to work within that middle power kind of webbing, if you like. So there's challenges, and it's not easy. There'll continue to be challenges going forward, because sometimes nations' interests align with whatever economic kind of benefit they might get from engaging with a China and so on. But again, having said that, by the way, a lot of countries have seen kind of the reaction to that, the negative to that. You know, some of the issues around the leasing of ports for a long period of time. I don't know if you know about the Sri Lanka issue. There's some of the issues even in Africa where some of the African nations are pushed back against the workers that were shipped in. And there's a real question mark about the economic benefits over time for the local population. It was more just the elites that were benefiting. But again, China itself evolves. I think that path, the end of that path, if you like, through the 21st century, is one in which if we can get to a point where we avoid conflict and confrontation and certainly war in the region, it is obviously going to be beneficial to the billions of people that live in the region. We don't want conflict here. It would be horrific. We've seen the effects on the global economy and the humanitarian effect of war in Ukraine and war in Gaza and so on. You know, it would be unthinkable and horrible to see that happen in the Indo-Pacific. Obviously, there are touch points here around Taiwan and the South China Sea and so on. We're trying to navigate through this as best as possible. And I would say one last thing about this. A lot of people say, well, why are you building up your defense capability and your intelligence and all this kind of stuff? Isn't that you hurtling towards, conflict? You're building up your weapons and all this kind of stuff. No, it's the inverse. The reason that you build up your defense capability and your cybersecurity, your intelligence, is to avoid conflict. It is to deter others from entering into conflict because it's too costly for them. And it's also an investment by us in peace, in relative peacetime. The better, the more we invest in these assets, the more we're avoiding having to spend way more of a percentage of our GDP on these assets if we are in conflict. I don't know if you know, but when Australia, in the middle of World War II, we were spending some 38, 40% of our GDP on defence. So we don't want to do that. We want to be able to spend enough now so that we have to avoid that situation. I think the same with the US. The US is a superpower. It has been a force for good in the region on the whole. The commitment by the US to the Indo-Pacific has been critical in allowing all these countries to flourish economically and trade and the prosperity that's good, because they've been the security guarantor. And we want to see that continue. We want to see US engagement in the Pacific as a partner. We understand now that, and I've said this to my US counterparts when I was in DC in the intelligence space, at Congress, at the Senate, when I visited my counterparts at the Senate Intelligence Committee and so on. You know, we're no longer just a bit player here, Australia. We are some of the operations in the region where we might have actually be playing quarterback on some of the plays, because we are with you in the region and with the US. It's not just you on your own carrying the can anymore. Sometimes we might be quarterback. We might be a defensive tight end. I don't know. You guys know better the NFL than me. But the point I'm making is that we're playing as a team now to protect that liberal rules-based order that's been beneficial to so many of us. And I want to have it in place for future generations, because it's going to be critical for peace, security, and stability in the region.
Well, Peter, since you decided to go NFL on me, I've got to ask you, since I did read your bio, and I understand that you have a long love affair with what you affectionately call footy in when you're AFL. Down under. And so for our non-Australian viewers and listeners, what is footy, and why are all the teams in Victoria?
Well, they're not all in Victoria, in our state, but footy or football, Australian Football League, is a far superior support than the NFL. We don't wear pads or helmets or any of that business. We tackle hard. We go hard. It's a real man's sport and a woman's sport now. There's a AFLW as well. Australians are built pretty tough, but it's a very athletic. A lot of athletes play this sport. Dynamic, fast. I think, Jim, you've been to a couple of games. 100,000 people we get every week at these games. It's incredible. It's great to watch. And we have a wonderful American-Australian by the name of Mason Cox, who plays for my team, the Collingwood Magpies, who's been a superstar in our league. He used to play college basketball down in, what was it, the college in Texas? I can't remember now.
Oklahoma.
He played in Oklahoma, not Texas. Sorry, he's from Texas. And he's been a great star. He's about 7 foot tall. But it's a great sport, Ray. You'd enjoy watching it.
We had a former ambassador from the U.S. who described it as making a prison riot look like a normal day.
I don't know.
I used to describe it to my friends as if we were all 12 years old and in my backyard and had a ball and made up a game, that's the game we would have made up.
Well, it's got a bit of everything, really, doesn't it? Yeah. You know, and I like baseball as well.
It does indeed.
So I got to go to Fenway Park a few times and watch the Red Sox. That's been fun.
Or go to New York and watch the real team.
I have to say, so I grew up a Red Sox fan, and I was used to years and years and years of futility because the Red Sox were the famous lovable losers under the curse of the Bambino. And then in 2004, they shocked the world. They beat the Yankees. They won the World Series. And I almost lost all interest in baseball after that. So I didn't know who I was anymore.
You're a Yankees
Peter
fan.
Peter Kalil, you have been a delight. Oh, no.
I can't go that far. This is the best record in the league, or either league, actually. I won't discuss it.
Well, again, Peter Kalil, you have been a delight. We do thank you for joining us, and we thank you for sharing your perspective. I think there's a ton that we can all learn from Australia's experience with foreign interference, and so we're glad to have had your insights.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks, Jim.
All right. Well, it was good talking to Peter. He's clearly a very knowledgeable interlocutor, knows a lot about intelligence, knows a lot about security, and is at the coalface of this issue of disinformation and foreign influence. And certainly something we're going to face here in the run-up to the elections.
Yeah, and I was really struck by his discussion about the ethnically Chinese Australians. Believe it or not, they're in our local community. They're in Isaacs. When we lived there, my wife and I went to an ethnically Chinese church. And of course, they came from everywhere, right? They were from Singapore, they were from Taiwan, they were from mainland, they were from Malaysia, they were from everywhere. Of course, many of them were second, third generation. So on one hand, of course, they did have to face a degree of racism and people who would just sort of lump them in. But they also got no favors from Beijing, where they're getting more and more of this rhetoric that is essentially saying China is a civilizational state, therefore all of you belong to us ultimately. And so if you're looking for a way to sort of fit in as an Aussie or as an American or whoever, and you're ethnically Chinese, you've got this voice coming from from Beijing that is undermining you, and it's sort of claiming you as their own, and it's really unfair. And I know that a lot of my friends kind of struggled with this because they were born Australian. That's all they've ever been, and now they've got these messages coming, and so it really is. It's a very insidious thing.
Well, and they're racist everywhere. There are racist Australians who are going to point to this and say, "You see, they're not real Australians."
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, and I think the other thing that we didn't really get into as much as I kind of wanted to was, sort of what happened around the universities, even when we were there, Jim. Because what you had was I think there was something to 15 to 20% of the students there were actually coming directly from mainland China, and a lot of them were getting in some of these universities, and some of them, of course, many of them were paying full tuition, which made the universities themselves sort of susceptible to manipulation. Because what would happen is if there were, pushbacks for political reasons or geopolitical reasons from Canberra against Beijing, all of a sudden the messages were, well, maybe our students don't feel safe in Australia anymore. And it was sort of this very, very thinly veiled threat of an economic punishment and sort of vectored through the universities so that there could be additional pressure on the government to let up on whatever they were trying to do.
It was one of the economic coercion tools in their kit, which is why when we were there, we kept talking about the need to diversify, which they're doing now.
And we're seeing that in other countries as well.
Absolutely. Anyway, Peter was great. There's a lot more we could have discussed, but he has a day job.
That's true.
Speaking of day jobs, what's your story for us?
Ah, well, I had a day job once, a very interesting day job in Washington, D.C. Not all the jobs in Washington, D.C. are interesting, but one that I had that was interesting was I was for 2 years, the commander of the U.S. Air Force Honor Guard. And the Honor Guard does a lot of really fascinating things. And one of them, of course, is funerals in Arlington National Cemetery for not just, people who fall in battle, but people who serve for a long time, and some of them with great distinction and some of them in foreign conflicts. And we had one for a former World War II veteran, former Army Air Corps at the time. And this individual happened to have been in the U.S. Senate, and I'll leave the name out of it. But but because he was a long-serving senator who had been in the Army Air Corps, we had a lot of important people showed up. And what made it very interesting is one day I'm sitting at my desk getting ready, sort of getting ready for the day. But one of the things I'm also getting ready for is this big funeral where we knew all these people are going to show up. And my phone rings, and it's a retired 4-star Air Force general who announces that he is a friend of the family of the senator who has passed on. And he has some very specific ideas about how the funeral should go. And of course, because, funerals are very highly scripted events, right? And, you train your honor guard and your band and all of the people who are involved in a funeral and how to do it a particular way. And so he wanted to throw in some curveballs. And one of the curveballs was there was going to be a 4-ship flyover of F-22 fighter jets, which is not unusual, but he wanted it to occur on the last note of taps. And why is that important? Well, TAPS comes, of course, at the end of all of what we call military honors. So there's going to be a 3-volley salute of the rifle guard is going to shoot 3 volleys, and then TAPS goes, right? Well, so that's going to take some amount of time, less than 4 minutes. And why is 4 minutes important? That's when you call in the fighters, right? They can't just fly around above head in Washington, D.C., because there's air traffic there. So you have to call them in 4 minutes out. So this 4-star general says, okay, last note of taps. And I say, sir, you do understand that's going to back us up. If I go back 4 minutes from the last note of taps, it's going to back us up to like in the middle of the chaplain's remarks. And he says, don't worry, I got the chaplain. And I'm thinking, right. It's the chaplain of the Senate. So I call my boss. I say, look, this just happened. He has a fit. He says, he can't do that. I say, yeah, who's going to stop him? And so we go into, you know, we go out. I actually ended up going out there, walking around the site with the general, with the retired general, and the guy from Air Combat Command who was going to have the radio to call in the jets. So day of the funeral, we've got all of these high-ranking officials there. We've got senators. We've got the Secretary of Defense is there. And I am standing at the foot of the casket in the middle of the chaplain's remarks, you know, sort of his eulogy. And I'm looking over the shoulder of the Air Force Chief of Staff at the head of the casket. Over his shoulder, I can see the Secretary of Defense, Bob Gates. Standing next to him is the retired four-star general, and standing next to him is the guy with the radio. And the chaplain is talking, and the chaplain is talking. And at a certain point, I see the general lean over and whisper something to the guy with the radio. Apparently, that was clearly the four-minute out mark, right? So he has timed the chaplain's remarks so that he knows exactly how much time he has left. And the chaplain is talking, and the chaplain is talking, and he's still talking, and I'm thinking, this is not going to work. And so as soon as the chaplain says, amen, I immediately start into funeral military honors, and I can already hear the jets, right? And they show up not on the last note of taps, but on the first note of taps, which means, of course, that nobody can hear taps. So it worked perfectly, except for the part that nothing worked. But of course, we knew that. But yeah, and I asked the general afterwards how he thought about it, and he said it was fine. So it was a day in the life, I guess, of Washington, D.C., of official Washington, where you plan everything down to the T and nothing quite ever works.
Well, you know, Ray, as long as the guest of honor didn't complain.
Bravo, sir. Bravo. All right. Thanks. And that on that note, thanks for joining us for this version or this edition of Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? And please join us again next time.